Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on uniformitarianism when we come back. You know, here's an interesting statement. It says, "Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men." You'll find that statement in Acts 5, verse 29. That's a pretty revolutionary concept, and it's impossible to put into practice unless you know the law. Now, can you imagine yourself actually telling a policeman or a judge that the law of God supersedes the law of your state? Well, there are actually three principles of law or authorities that support Peter's position in Acts 5, verse 29. The first one is called the First Amendment. The second one is Public Law 97-280. And the third one is Seeger versus United States. Now, do you know the scriptural law to cite in support of your position on, say, the census or public school or Social Security, vaccinations, or the many other laws of the scripture that conflict with the laws of your state? And do you know how to look them up, research them out, or code plead the law to use the scripture to defend yourself against these state and federal incursions into your constitutional or your biblical rights? Because if you don't know the law of the scripture and you don't know the law of your state, then how are you going to challenge them? Now, if you're tired of being a biblical illiterate with the police and public officials kicking sand in your face, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, and you can click on to our archives page, and then you can download that free general law CD package right there off the Internet. That's georgegordon.org. Hey, we've been talking about uniformitarianism. Last time we took a look at the Big Bang Theory and comets. Let's take a look at the two laws of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics, it's a big word, and for us lay people, it really doesn't mean a whole lot unless somebody from science explains it to us. So fortunately, some of the scientists involved have explained it kind of like this. Laws are those events or those phenomena that we observe that repeat themselves over and over again. The law of gravity. When you drop a weight off of a high place, it falls at a certain rate. It reaches what they call terminal velocity. And if you dropped a 1 pound weight and a 5 pound weight, you know, us lay people would assume that the 5 pound weight will fall five times faster than the 1 pound weight because gravity would attract it five times greater than the 1 pound weight. But when we actually test that, some guy went up on the Tower of Pizza one time, Tower of Pisa, and he dropped these two weights and they both fell at the same rate to the ground. Now, this is real science. That's the laboratory at work. And that's what I started off on this series of programs to point out, that there are some real laws out here, phenomenon, that occur over and over again that you can observe. Now, when that happens, we call that law. that's always going to work that way. So if we take a look at these laws of thermodynamics, then if we took off that law of thermodynamics, the first law, energy is conserved. What they're talking about here is energy, and that this energy dissipates. Energy is conserved and energy dissipates. That's the two laws of thermodynamics. Kind of scientific gobbledygook there to plumbers and carpenters. But now, we can observe this, and you and I, just, you know, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, and housewives, and truck drivers, you know, we can actually do this ourselves. And then that's what science is all about. And then when we do that, we're going to come to some kind of a conclusion, you know, and our minds will sit there and we'll say, well, you know, here's what I'm actually seeing. And then when somebody says, well, this is the way this is, then you can actually go test it and find out, is that guy telling me the truth or is he pulling my leg? Well, listen to this. All existing processes of nature merely change energy from one form to another. In nature, energy is neither created nor destroyed. Matter itself, which is potential atomic energy, is maintained at a constant level. Processes change matter and energy from one form to another, but the total quantity of energy in the universe always remains the same. Now, let's just test this for a minute. Take a match and strike it, and just hold it. And notice that it burns and burns and burns. And it just keeps burning and burning. But notice that it keeps coming closer and closer to your fingers. All right? Now, set the match down so that it can completely burn up. You know, set it in the ashtray. Being careful. Don't break it now. Just set it in the ashtray so that it can burn up. Now, when it burns up totally, and all you got left here is just a little black stick, what happened to all of the other chemicals, the smoke, the heat? Well, it's all there. It's in the air. It's invisible. You can't see it. The smoke has dissipated, but all of the little particles that burned up, they changed. The oxygen changed to water that was used in the combustion process, and the match was burned up to ash, and the ash is left. The truth of the matter is, all of the weight, all of the mass and matter is still here on planet Earth. It didn't escape. It's not gone. It isn't destroyed. It's all here, but it's in a different form. It's a different form. And so you can observe that yourself, and then if you were smart enough to put a lid over the top of this thing and capture all the smoke and all the heat and everything that's in there, and then go weigh that, you'd come up with the same weight. You'd have the same amount. Isn't that amazing? All right, that's number one. The second law is called energy dissipates. Now, as processes in nature occur, the total energy reservoir is reduced to simpler forms with a consequent increase in what has been termed entropy. Entropy, E-N-T-R-O-P-Y. As energy is used, it becomes less available for further use. Part of the energy spent to produce something is always lost by radiation, friction, or other effects. It becomes non-recoverable heat dissipating in space. Ultimately, as things are going, the entire universe will end up being filled with a stagnant mass of low-level heat energy. So if we just sat here and watched, like our sun out there is burning up at the rate of 5 feet an hour, if you just sit here and you watch, when it's all said and done, the sun is going to burn up and it is going to totally disappear. But all of the mass and matter that was there at the original creation of the sun is still in the universe. It didn't go anywhere. It's still right there. But it will be in the form of low energy heat. Low energy heat. But it's still going to be there. Now, that's kind of amazing. That's called physics. I didn't invent it. I didn't make it. I'm just a reporter, just here to tell you. But hell, that's what all of us observe. When you burn a match in an ashtray, that's exactly what you're observing there. When you burn the sun up, it takes a lot longer, and we're not going to be here for the next 100,000 years to make these observations. But we can make the observations today, and they've been doing this over the past 100 years. And over 100 years, while they've been observing this and writing down what their observations are and what the size was 100 years ago and the size is today, and made some calculations, and the sun is burning up. That's the bottom line. Now, when God created this, let's just go back here for a minute. I'm going to start thinking of the other side over here for a minute. When God created this, then he had to start with energy. Now, I would imagine God's got quite a bit of energy, and he took that energy and he used it in the reverse process. If we knew how to do this, we could take the energy that has been used up from the sun, changed from its original form into its low-level energy mass, somewhere here in the universe. If we could reverse that process, we could make the sun gain 5 feet an hour. It would grow bigger by 5 feet an hour. It's kind of like taking lead and turning it into gold. It's obvious that of the 92 elements that are in the element chart, that they all come from hydrogen. Now, the trick is, how do you take that hydrogen and make it a little heavier and turn it into helium? How do you take that helium and make it a little heavier by adding some atoms to it and turning it into iron and uranium and other things? Now, there's a guy out there, we call him God. Now, he's a pretty smart fella. He was able to do that. He knows how to do that. You and I haven't figured that out yet. But we can see how it works. We can see how he did that. There's a reverse process. Now, if you take a look at a clock, I've got one upstairs, a grandfather's clock, and you look at the weights and they're clear up to the top, you know that it's just been wound up. And I can go out and say, who wound up the clock? And Dirk will say, well, I did. I just wound it up. Now, when those weights are about halfway down, we can make an observation. Well, let's see. Dirk wound that thing up about 10 o'clock yesterday morning. And now the weights are about halfway down. And right away, when I see them at the halfway point, I say, that clock is going to stop in about 4 days, unless we rewind that clock. Because it's an 8-day clock. When you put it up to the top, those weights go down, and when they get to the bottom, 8 days from now, that clock will stop. The universe that we're looking at right here was wound up, and right now it's running down, burning up. It's being consumed. And we can observe that right now today. It's called entropy. That's not evolution. That's the exact opposite to evolution. See, what these guys are telling us through uniformitarianism over here is that what we're observing in the universe today has been going on for billions of years. And it's called uniformitarianism. And they tell us how stars are being born. Excuse me. Stars aren't being born. Stars are being burned up. They are going out of existence. They used to be there, but now they burned up and they're gone. That's what we're actually observing. But what they're telling us is, oh no, 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 they're not burning up, they're not being consumed, they're being born. Stars are burning up, but there's others being born. And what they're saying, in effect, is creation is still going on. Now, the Creator said on the sixth day, he said, I'm going to rest now, and the creation is finished. Now, when we actually take a look at the creation, we can see that, yep, it was finished. It was wound up at one time, but it's running down. Now, no discovery of true science takes God by surprise, and we should expect that. In God's wisdom, there would be hints of these truths found in the Scripture. And number one, the first law speaks of a total creation originally completed and now sustained by God's power. And secondly, the second law speaks of the curse of decay and death brought on by man's sin and causing an overall degeneration in everything around us. Orderly things become disordered. New things get old and break down. Living things age, wear out, and die. And this is called the second law of thermodynamics, and it's one of the most constant laws of nature. It's found everywhere in the universe. It's sometimes referred to as the law of entropy. Now, the Latin word from which evolution comes from literally means an outrolling. It indicates something spiraling from the infinitesimal to all of reality. The word entropy comes from the Greek word meaning in turning. Notice the polarity of difference. Evolution, change outward and upward. Entropy, change inward and downward. Every energy system in the universe wears out. Stars burn out, galaxies fly apart, energy becomes less and less useful through time. Science now is painfully aware of the rigidity of this natural law. The impossibility of the perpetual motion machine verifies the consistent observation that everything in our physical universe is running down. The conservation principle of the first law of thermodynamics is easily understood in the context of completed creation, which is now being sustained by the Creator. For instance, all things were created through Him, past tense. Notice it is not a continuing process. In Him, all things consist. The Greek word for sustain, for example, nothing is lost from it. We see that in Colossians 1, verses 16 and 17. He made, upholding all things by the word of His power, Hebrews 1, verses 2 and 3. By the word of God, heavens and earth reserved, kept in store, 2 Peter 3, verses 5 through 7. The decay principle is consistent with the entire scripture in light of the curse in Eden. We see that in Psalms 102, verse 26. Even they will perish, the starry heavens, but you do endure, and all of them will wear out like a garment. As Romans 8, verse 22 says, the whole creation groans and suffers. This seems contrary to God's original purpose for a creation, which He called very good. The death and decay was obviously not intended to prevail, as it does now, nor will it dominate the universe in the kingdom of God is described in Revelation chapter 22, verse 3. The result of man's sin, described in Genesis 3, verse 17, has even affected the ground, the very elements of the physical creation, including the dust of which Adam was made. The second law began then, decay, entropy, destruction. Before that, some higher law of perfection and preservation must have been in effect. Such supernatural care was indeed in effect, at least partially, during Israel's 40-year episode in the wilderness. You'll see that in Nehemiah 9, verse 21. And the Bible makes clear the fact that the second law is not permanent. The Creator Himself has promised that the curse of decay is not endless. Creation will be set free from the bondage of decay, we see in Romans 8, verse 21, and no more curse in Revelation 22, verse 2. So think now. The second law of thermodynamics proves there had to be a beginning once or else all creation would have been dead by now. The first law proves that all that exists must have been created by a designer because no process in nature creates anything. We are not witnessing creation, boys and girls. We are witnessing destruction. Now, evolution comes along. Uniformitarianism says, oh no, you're not witnessing destruction. You're witnessing creation. Well, okay, believe what you want. But you ought to believe what your eyes see. And when you're watching the weights in the clock case as they're going down, you'll know that unless somebody intervenes and sustains it by pulling them back up to the top, applying energy and pulling those weights to the top, that clock is going to stop. Now, the universe requires some sustenance. And there's a creator out there and says, well, I sustain all this. And this thing out here is running. It's running down, and I sustain it. And it's mine. I own it. He also identifies himself as the owner of it. And he also tells us that the thing had a creation. It had a beginning. It started out and it was wound up. And it's running down. That's all. Just that simple. So we've got these two exact opposites. You've got, on the one hand, people that say this is science, which has nothing to do with it. Science is knowledge. These people are ignorant. Well, what they're talking about here is ignorance. Believing that you evolve and you're getting bigger and better and smarter is counter to everything that we observe around us. It's the exact opposite. Now, science is actually made up of what we can see, hear, taste, touch, and smell. It's your five senses, boys and girls. Hey, what are you looking at here? Now, let's add this up. Wake up and smell the coffee. God commanded, created, and established them forever. That's the stars. In Psalm 148, verses 5 and 6, He created, and not one fails. Isaiah 40, verse 26. The Eternal made all things and preserves them all. Nehemiah 9, verse 6. And it's clear from Genesis chapter 1 and the first three verses of chapter 2 that whatever methods God used to create were stopped. They're stopped. He rested from all of His work, and He called it very good. That's in Genesis 2:2 and in 1:31. The creation was completed on the sixth day of creation, and from that point on, this thing's running down. Now, let's take a look at design. You know, the very idea of all this magnificent order happening by chance with no designer has about as much chance as a monkey sitting down at a typewriter and pounding out the entire dictionary letter perfect. And yet, as absurd as that is, evolutionists insist that it must have happened that way by chance. Well, if there wasn't a creator, then chance is the most logical thing that we would have available to us as an answer. So when the naturalist, in this case, you know, the uniformitarian, comes along and says, well, I don't believe in God, and I don't believe in the supernatural religion and the Bible, and yet I'm confronted with all of this order around me. I can see that the earth moves around the sun in 365 days and a few hours. It's a quarter of a day, about 6 hours and some minutes. And you can sit here and you can predict, well, next year it's going to take exactly the same amount of time. And the year after that, it's going to take exactly the same amount of time. Now, it isn't quite exactly the same, because I saw the other day that they had to set an atomic clock in Washington, D.C., because the Earth is slowing down, and so they had to reset the clock. Okay, how do you like that? So, I don't know how often this happens, but every once in a while they got to slow it down, because the Earth is slowing down. Not much at a time, but, you know, every 100 years it's a second here and a second there, you know. So they gotta make some changes. Now, that tells us exactly what we've already learned so far. That's called entropy. The universe is running down. But notice that the order that it's in. The moon moves around the earth, you know, give or take a billionth of a second every year, or whatever it takes. And it takes 29 and a half days. And it takes 365 days to move around the sun. But it's being done with remarkable accuracy. And when you go to shoot a rocket off, you know, to Mars, you want to drop a payload onto Mars. Well, you can actually predict where Mars is going to be 6 months from now when the Martian lander, the Mars lander, reaches Mars. And that's pretty damn accurate. Mars is moving around the sun just like the Earth is, and it's got its orbit, and it takes a certain amount of time. Here's the point. I mean, this thing is well designed. Now, if there's no designer, well, then it just happened by chance, which we discussed early on here when we were talking about the Big Bang. What's the chances of this happening? Well, the chances of it happening by chance is zero. So we have to have a creator. And so the evolutionist comes along and says, well, I don't believe in a creator, so we have to have chance. See where we're going with this? I mean, you know, come on. We've got an insane conversation going here. So let's take a look. Let's think about this for a moment. Let's say you're out taking a stroll one day. And you're going along the lake shore. You happen to look down and spot a piece of flint that catches your attention. You bend down, you pick it up, you brush it off. And lo and behold, you realize that you've discovered an ancient arrowhead, an Indian arrowhead. You marvel at its careful design, a simple bit of technology yet profoundly informative. You ever seen one of those Indian flint arrowheads? They're in just about every museum. Around here, you can actually find them. Right here in Isabella, Missouri, my wife had about 20 or 30 of them. And you look at that and you say, you know, someone had to make this. And you realize that fact instinctively. There isn't any doubt about it. The symmetry of the little point gives it away. It is not the product of random erosion over the years as the waves of the lake lapped its shores. No, sir. Any thinking person looking at that arrowhead would realize that it's been designed and formed, and that somebody who was a thinking person had to design and form that little tool. Now let's turn to a wildflower, just a step away. Now there's a honeybee hovering over its bright petals. Now let's take a look at the design, the complexity, the detailed intricacy of that little plant and animal relationship. That is a wonder that you are beholding. The idea of computers or any other relic of technology just happening by sheer chance, let alone the astounding complexity of the human brain, has about as much chance as a monkey typing the unabridged dictionary perfectly by chance. For example, none. But wait, hasn't life been created synthetically in a test tube? No, it hasn't. But let me ask you this. Let's suppose that somebody did create life in a test tube. What would that tell you? Would you then conclude that life evolved because scientist Joe Smedley created life in a test tube in the laboratory? Is that what your conclusion would be? My conclusion would be the exact opposite. Mine would be that it required an intelligent scientist to create that life in the laboratory. It had to be designed and carefully thought out. There had to be Bunsen burners and test tubes. And there had to be the original material, and there had to be a thinking, logical mind behind it that combined the parts and made it function. Because that's exactly what you're observing. You're not observing evolution when a scientist creates life in a test tube in a laboratory. You are watching a creator creating and making a creation. That's what you're watching. Think about it. Now, so far we have not been able to create life, but we're working on it. Listen, when Monsanto can take a life form, like a tomato, and then splice a gene from a flounder out of the North Atlantic Ocean into it to make it hardier and more frost or cold resistant, you know, those are creative abilities. That's not evolution. You don't see flounders jumping out of the Atlantic Ocean and crawling across the land to see how they can splice their genes with a tomato. I say that the flounder has to come to the tomato because I don't think the tomato can jump into the North Atlantic and work with the flounder to create this gene splicing technique. But when I see that, I say that's an intelligent creation going on there, and it's not of any small report either. That's quite a little step forward there if you want to create life, splicing genes into into other living organisms over there. That's quite a little trick. Now, what's been done in the laboratory, amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, which in turn are a part of all living cells, have been experimentally produced in controlled laboratory tests. So we have made some amino acids, which are a part of a cell, but that's a far cry from the production of life. Now think about it. Enzymes can only be produced by living cells, and yet living cells absolutely require many specialized enzymes in order to survive. So is it any wonder why some leading evolutionists have finally faced reality? Sir Fred Hoyle is one. He says the chances of life evolving without intelligent design are comparable to a tornado ripping through a junkyard and producing a Boeing 747 all by itself. Now, tornadoes rip through junkyards, and when they do, they produce greater disorder and destruction. They've never produced anything, and that's because they can't. There's no design. Chance doesn't produce anything. It produces disorder, but it doesn't produce anything in an orderly fashion. Now, that's what we observe. Now, you can believe that, well, given enough tornadoes and enough junkyard, over time, it would indeed produce a 747. Okay. I'm not arguing with you. If you want to believe that, get after it. But it's never happened before. Tain't happening today. Then it ain't going to happen in the future. But if you want to believe, once upon a time, far, far away, that's your privilege. Yeah, I got to give you a reminder here, if I can find my paper. Yep, here it is. At the halfway point, I have to comply here with the Federal Communications Commission and a whole host and plethora of other outfits all around the world here, and remind you that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, you can get that from our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. You can order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the archives page when you get there, and you should be able to download that free general law CD package. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the very idea of all this magnificent order happening by chance with no designer has about as much chance as a monkey sitting down at a typewriter and pounding out the entire dictionary. Letter perfect. And yet, as absurd as that is, evolutionists insist that it must have happened that way by chance. So let's think about that. Let's say that you're out taking a stroll one day and you're going by the lake shore, and you see an arrowhead. Do you say to yourself, well, I think that that thing was formed by chance? When you see an automobile, do you go by it and say, gee, I think that thing was formed by chance? I mentioned in the last program, I said, if you threw 12 buttons off the back of a truck moving at 30 miles an hour, would you say that by chance those buttons should fall on the pavement, align themselves into three rows of four buttons each, 1 inch apart? You see, mathematically, when you work that out, it comes to it just can't happen, doesn't happen, and it mathematically is impossible to happen. And yet these people say, well, it must have happened that way, and we believe it. So a cell, which is made up of 11,000 parts, as small as it is, 11,000 parts go into a cell. And that cell has all these little intricate parts, and it's working, and it's alive, and it's doing these things. That cell is more than 12 buttons. It's 11,000 buttons. And all of those parts of that cell have to work perfectly, or the cell dies. It's kind of like our bodies. Your body's got one liver, but it's got a lot of parts. And if the liver fails, the whole system fails, and it dies. So it either all works or it doesn't. It's kind of like anything else that we see out here. The complexity of things demand a designer to put them together and make them work. A Ford automobile requires a designer because it's got 13 or 14,000 parts in it. A Ford automobile is a little bit more complex than a cell. Ford automobiles don't put themselves together accidentally. Cells don't put themselves together accidentally. Now, evolutionary ideas require lots of time. So does 4.5 billion years sound like enough time? In fact, evolutionary speculation seems to keep raising the age of the Earth by about the rate of doubling every 30 years or less. Recently, they've been insisting on our point. That's 6 billion years. Six. But given enough time, that may be soon protracted to a full 5 billion. So they used to say, well, it was 2 billion years old, then it raised it to 4, then 4.5 billion. Now I just showed you they're up to around, the universe, so 15 to 18 billion. Suppose you were a high school student assigned to write a term paper for your biology teacher, and imagine the look on your teacher's face if you propose to elucidate on the theory that modern man evolved from a single cell amoeba in just 2 seconds. Ridiculous, he would say. Well, that's rightfully so. But you're determined to come up with something new and scientifically stimulating, so you think a while and return with a new twist. How about the idea that man evolved from amoeba in 2 billion years, you ask? So with a wry smile on his face, your teacher smugly tells you, now you've got the right idea. Now, do you see what just happened? Give it billions of years, and... Now, did you realize that our Earth is regularly gathering dust from the cosmos, and then so is the moon? Well, here on Earth, the dust is hardly detectable. Even so, we should expect millions of tons of dust. Millions of tons of it has washed into the sea over the last few billion years, but we don't find it. Now, since the moon has no erosion, but it is also accumulating cosmic dust at a regular rate, we should discover something. Well, at present rates, NASA experts were expecting a tremendous layer of dust on the moon due to its 4.5 to 5 billion year supposed age. The most conservative estimates were expecting 54 feet of dust on the moon. Now, can you imagine landing on a flour sack that deep? Now, what a surprise when men did finally land on the moon and they found only 1/8 of an inch at the shallowest and up to 3 inches of dust at the deepest. Now, that much would have taken fewer than 8,000 years to stack up. Is it possible that maybe the moon really hasn't been there any longer than 8,000 years? Now, one of the most commonly heard beliefs of evolution and evolutionary dogma is the idea that everything in reality is only the result of pure chance. The infinite evidence in nature of orderliness, complexity, and design is only apparent to the evolutionist and not real. He sees it, but it doesn't register. The implication of such thinking is that there really isn't any order in anything because everything is just the result of random, accidental chance. Now let's think for a minute. Is it possible for the precise organization of parts in living systems to come into existence by mere chance? Well, what is random chance anyway? Well, when flipping a coin, you have a chance of 1 in 2 that it will turn up heads. How likely is it that 3 objects would be arranged in a certain way if they were spilled out onto the table? Well, the chances can be figured by a simple mathematical equation. In this case, it is expressed as 3 and is called 3-factorial. And the calculation is figured this way. It's 1 times 2 times 3 equals 6. So, there are 6 ways to arrange 3 parts in a simple sequence. So, when you start adding parts, the chances grow very slim, very fast. For example, what are the chances of blindly arranging, by chance, 6 different items in 1 perfect order? The result is 1 out of 6, which is calculated as 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6, which equals 720. So, if you took 3 things in your hand, you know, like 3 coins, and you threw them into the air, what's the chances of them arranging themselves 1 inch apart in 3, in a line, or all 3 coming up heads, or the middle one coming up heads and the other 2 coming up tails? Now come up with a sequence over there, and the answer is 1 out of 720. Now for the time being, let's forget the problem of how the first living cell happened by chance with its multiplied thousands of specially organized parts. Let's just look at the odds of arranging a system of 200 parts. Not thousands, just 200. The human skeleton has about 200 bones. So what are the chances of getting all of those bones all put in the right order from the beginning? 200 bones. So how many possible ways are there to arrange a system with 200 parts? And what are the chances of having all of those parts fall into place at any given moment in time? So the number 200, that is the factorial, it's immense. It's represented by the number 10 with 375 zeros after it. There's no way to imagine that number. So each time you try a new arrangement of your 200 parts, you use up one of your chances. So let's say that you can sort out your 200 parts a new way every second. Now, remember, there is only one correct way out of 200 different possibilities. How many seconds are there in a year? Well, there are 60 seconds times 60 minutes, which equals 3,600 seconds per hour, times 24 hours, that equals 86,400 seconds in a day, times 365 days, that equals 31,536,000 seconds in a year. Well, then in a billion years, there are 3, 6, 9, 12, 31 quadrillion, 536 trillion seconds. In 10 billion years, I can't read the number. How much is that? Well, it's under a third of a billion billions. But 200 amounts to 10 with 375 zeros after it. The total number of electrons that could be packed into the entire universe would only total 10 with 130 zeros after it. All right, now let me repeat this for you again. When we're talking about chance, your body has 206 bones in it, so just round it off to 200. All of the bones in your body are arranged in a particular order. Did you notice that your right thumb is on your right hand, and your left thumb is on your left hand? And did you notice that your two hands, one hand on one side and one hand on the other, are opposite from one another? So if you were to get your right thumb over on your left thumb, or you got, you know, your right wrist bone over on your left wrist bone, it would be in error. See? So the chances of getting all 200 bones into the correct order, in the correct way. For instance, the bones have to be end-to-end in the right configuration, don't they? I mean, your left leg bone could be one end or the other. Because, see, the hip bone has to fit into the hip. And if it got upside down and the knee end was up to the hip, that would be backwards, wouldn't it? You know, just by chance. And we won't get into, well, how did these bones get made in the configuration that they're in? We'll leave that out. We'll just presume that you've got all of the right lengths and the right configurations and right design of all the bones. We're just going to put all the bones into a box and then throw the box on the floor. And how long will it take? So when we go through the amount of seconds that there are in an hour and the amount of seconds there are in a billion years and so on, you'd have to have 10 with 375 zeros behind it to get you enough seconds that you could put this thing together by random chance. Now, how many electrons? Now, do you know what an electron is? See, you got a molecule. The molecule is made up of atoms. Then you've got an atom, and then the atom is made up of electrons. So these electrons are pretty small little dudes. Now, to give you an idea as to how big the universe is, they just finished working on the Hubble telescope the other day. And the Hubble telescope, they tell us, can look out 12.5 billion light years, and they think with the new upgrade they can look out 25 billion light years. Now, one light year is the amount of distance that it takes for light traveling at 186,000 miles a second to travel for one full year. That's a lot of miles. That's one light year. Hubble can look out 12.5 billion light years, and now they think it can reach out 25 billion light years. Now take all of those stars and take all of those planets and all of the black holes and quasars and break them down into atoms, which is pretty small. All right, here's how many there are. That's a 10 with 130 zeros after it. But the amount of time that you got to have to arrange these 200 bones is 10 with 375 zeros after it. And that's just one system of only 200 parts. What about the chances of all the millions of parts of the millions of organisms on Earth coming together in certain ways with no design, no pattern, and no system behind it? In other words, no creator. Boys and girls, the concept of it is so stupid. I don't think anybody ever told you those numbers before. But I just did. I just reported it to you. Tain't never happened. Tain't happening now. Tain't never going to happen. Period. Now, there's a designer out there. Now, you could sit there and argue about Allah and God and Jesus and all these various concepts if you want to get into religion. See? And I'm not sure that religion's got any better answers than evolution does. Now, the scripture does, and the creator does, but then that's not religion, that's science. And I've heard a guy the other day, just watching a tape the other day, and he made that same apology for Jesus. Jesus, just dumb, you know, he didn't know what the hell he was doing. And he said that the Bible was not a science book. The Bible is full of science. It's not 100% science, but it certainly is a science book, and it speaks about science. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a science statement. I mean, hell, the guys that are preaching evolution come to you and say, once upon a time, long, long ago, there was a dot at the end of the sentence that exploded and made everything in the universe, and they call that science. The opposite to that is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's science. The difference is that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We can observe. We can see it, weigh it, taste it, touch it, smell it, and hear it. And then once upon a time, long ago, a dot at the end of this page is just pure fairy tale. Nothing more, nothing less. And even mathematically, you know, these are the guys that run around. This is their argument now. They're running around telling us, given enough time, this could all happen. But now when you actually put the numbers to it, when you put the metal to the pedal to the metal, there's 60 seconds in a minute. There's 3,600 seconds in an hour. There's 24 hours in a day. That's 86,400 seconds in a day times 365 days is 31,536,000 seconds a year. Now, in a billion years, there's 31,536 followed by 36,912 seconds. So that's 31,536 trillion seconds. In 10 billion years, there's 36,912. 315,360 trillion seconds. Now, how much is that? Well, it's under a third of a billion seconds. You know, 10 billion years. That's under a third of a billion seconds. All right. Now, let's take a look at 200 bones, 10 with 375 zeros behind it, is way more than 10 with 130 zeros behind it, and that's how many atoms there are in the entire damn universe. Well, so far as we can see. And then all that now just going to put itself together in that amount of time. There ain't enough time out there. 15 to 18 billion years a drop in a bucket. They haven't even got the beginning of what they need for time. Now, that's what happens when you put random chance down and apply a mathematical formula to it. It falls right on its face. Genesis 1 doesn't. Genesis 1 is what we're actually looking at. That's what we actually see. Now, some guy comes along and says, but we've got carbon-14 dating methods available. Why, we've got radiometric dating. And now we've got science working for us. Well, let's take a look at radiometric dating. How's that? Now that we've looked at design, random chance. During the last few decades, the popular press has frequently asserted millions of years and dates as authoritatively true based on radiometric tests. The most commonly reported tests are called potassium argon. The second is uranium lead, and the third is carbon-14. So there's three of these tests. If you're writing this down, it's potassium argon, that's number one. Uranium lead is number two. Carbon-14 is number three. So how do these work? Well, these three systems are based on several assumptions about the decay processes of these unstable elements. For example, radioactive uranium, since it's unstable, gradually breaks down to form the very stable element lead. Because the decay process is very slow, these processes are supposed to be good ways to find ages in the millions and billions of years. Now, with the exception of carbon-14, these few processes can only be observed in igneous rocks. So volcanic rocks usually are tested to yield the supposed age of a fossil or an artifact that is found buried beneath them. The conclusion is that an object buried under a certain layer of rock, whose age can be established, must be at least as old as the rock. Since the rock is assumed to have erupted after the object was embedded in the underlying stratum. It makes all the sense in the world. I wouldn't argue with that. You're out here poking around in the rocks, and you find a fossil on top of the fossil or other layers of rock. If we could determine that the layer of rock that's directly on top of the fossil was a million years old, then we would conclude that the fossil has to be at least a million years old, wouldn't we? Yeah, that's pretty good. So now our problem is, well, then how do we date these rocks? So are these tests consistent? Well, when the Apollo 11 mission brought moon rock and soil samples back, the uranium lead tests on them produced four different dates. First, 4.6 billion years, 5.4 billion years, 4.8 billion years, 8.2 billion years. So how do we know which figure is correct? And how do we know that any of those four figures are correct? Well, according to Science magazine, potassium-argon tests on lunar rocks revealed an age of 2.3 billion years. And you'll see that in volume 167, which was produced on January 30th, 1970. So what is the acid test for these radiometric dating systems? Well, the best way to test a clock's accuracy is to compare it to a standard. In other words, you need to check it with a known reliable source. Now, volcanic lava rocks from Hawaii were subjected to potassium-argon testing, and the result was 160 million to 3 billion years ago is when these rocks supposedly originated. Upon further checking, it was discovered that the particular lava flow from which these rocks were taken actually erupted in the year 1801. Okay, so you want to know how accurate the potassium-argon dating method is. Well, volcanic lava rock, which was extruded in 1801, was tested by the potassium-argon method, and it dated 160 million to 3 billion years old. Now, I want to point out to you, boys and girls, that when you put 3 billion, which my calculator won't even take, 3 billion, and then divide that by 160 million, that looks like about 10, 20, 30. And that looks like about 20 times error factor to me. I mean, was it 160 million years ago, or was it 350 million years ago, or was it a billion years ago, or was it 3 billion years ago? I mean, if you ask me, when did I go to Springfield, and I said, well, it was between 1968 and 1977, wouldn't you say, well, could you get a little closer than that? We'll take it up right there next time, potassium-argon dating. Meanwhile, let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week.